Africa. Today is Wednesday, February 24th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, a U.S. congressional hearing looks into the January 6th Capitol riot.
What we got was a military-style coordinated assault on my officers and a violent takeover of the Capitol building.
Also ahead, do big tech companies have too much power?
The real source of power is being a gatekeeper, being an intermediary that everyone has to pass through.
Plus, rescue efforts for endangered orangutans in Indonesia. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S., where for the first time Tuesday, U.S. lawmakers heard details about the security failures on January 6th when pro-Trump rioters breached the U.S. Capitol. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on the steps taken to prevent more domestic extremist attacks.
6 weeks after the deadly riot at the U.S. Capitol, top security officials told lawmakers they were unprepared for the unprecedented scope of the assault. Former chief of the U.S. Capitol Police, Stephen Sund.
We properly planned for a mass demonstration with possible violence. What we got was a military-style coordinated assault on my officers and a violent takeover of the Capitol building.
The U.S. Capitol is protected by its own $516 million police force. Local D.C. police and federal authorities were also consulted in the days leading up to Trump's Stop the Steal rally, held as Congress met to certify the November presidential election. Former House Sergeant-at-Arms Paul Irving.
Everyone was very satisfied that we had a robust plan, security plan, that was consistent with the intelligence that we had at the time.
Sund told lawmakers that preparation would have been different if he had been made aware of a January 5th FBI warning of an increase in the violence of protester threats. Democratic Senator Gary Peters.
How could you not get that vital intelligence on the eve of what's going to be in a major event?
Former chief of the U.S. Capitol Police, Stephen Sund.
That's something we need to look at. What's the process and how do we streamline that information getting to where it needs to go?
The exact reason for a significant delay in calling on National Guard reinforcements also is still unclear, as officials disputed the timeline of events during the assault. Acting chief of the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, Robert J. Conte III.
I was surprised at the reluctance to immediately send the National Guard to the Capitol grounds.
More than 250 people have already been charged for their role in the riot. The top security officials agreeing the attack on Congress was clearly coordinated beforehand. Acting chief of the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, Robert J. Conte III.
It was radio communication by several individuals that were involved. The coordinated use of chemical munitions to include bear spray by several people that were out there. I certainly believe it was coordinated.
Tuesday's hearing marks just the beginning of congressional investigations into the worst breach of the U.S. Capitol in two centuries. Testimony from Pentagon officials is expected next week. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Following the Capitol riot, U.S. technology companies with millions of users worldwide face renewed scrutiny and stepped-up efforts by some legislators to regulate them. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
In the wake of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, there is renewed interest in looking at the power of technology giants. Protesters reportedly used social media to plan. Facebook and Twitter kicked off their sites. Former President Donald Trump and others, Google, Apple, and Amazon, booted Parler, an app used by supporters of Trump. Jerry Davis is a professor of management at the University of Michigan who spoke to VOA over Skype.
The real source of power is being a gatekeeper, being an intermediary that everyone has to pass through. That's really the thing that we want to look at.
Scrutinizing so-called big tech is nothing new. Google, Facebook, and Amazon are already facing antitrust investigations, and tech CEOs routinely testify in Congress. While many agree that tech has too much power, they differ on what to do about it. Break up the companies, restrict their abilities to collect user data, and allow users to sue if their privacy is violated, put laws in place to make the firms responsible if they are conduits for online falsehoods? India McKinney is the Director of Federal Affairs at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She spoke to VOA over Skype.
The Republicans are upset at what they see is cancel culture or companies moderating conservative speech on their platforms. And Democrats tend to be more concerned that platforms aren't moderating enough and are leaving up too much hate speech or too much harassment.
When it comes to online misinformation, something both parties say is a problem, creating new rules can be difficult, particularly in the U.S., where the First Amendment protects speech. India McKinney.
How do you write a piece of legislation that makes illegal misinformation but protects satire and parody and comedy and commentary and hyperbole and like all of these other things that we use for entertainment and that are important parts of political discussion and discourse?
What's needed, say some observers, is a fresh look at big tech's power, including how the technology itself works in uniting or dividing people. Nicole Turner-Lee is a senior fellow and director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. She spoke to VOA over Skype.
I think a national conversation on this. What are the rules of the road? What's the appropriate conduct? How do we keep people safe? And I think that is really a turning point.
Over coming months, more users and governments worldwide will debate tech's role as powerful gatekeepers for society. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
In other tech news, Facebook will restore Australian news pages after Canberra offered amendments to legislation that would force the tech giants to pay for media content. That's according to Treasurer Josh Frydenberg on Tuesday. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Following a tense standoff between Australia and Facebook for more than a week, the Australian government has finally struck a deal after tweaks to a proposed law forcing big tech to pay for media content. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg confirmed the deal on Tuesday after talks with Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg over the weekend.
Well, Facebook has refriended Australia, and Australian news will be restored to the Facebook platform. And Facebook has committed to entering into good faith negotiations with Australian news media businesses.
Four changes will be made, including one which allows 2 months for internet companies to strike private deals for news content before the government-appointed arbitrator intervenes. In response to the changes, Facebook said in a statement, quote, "We are satisfied that the Australian government has agreed to a number of changes that recognise the value our platform provides to publishers relative to the value we receive from them. In return, Facebook will restore Australian news pages after it abruptly blocked publishers and users in Australia from sharing or viewing news content last week. The move was criticised widely as Facebook also scrubbed pages of state government, emergency information and non-profit charities. World leaders have been watching the negotiations closely as countries like Canada and Britain consider similar legislation.
That was Libby Hogan of Reuters. This is VOA. Golf superstar Tiger Woods was rushed to a Los Angeles hospital in serious condition Tuesday after his car went off a road and rolled down a steep hillside. The cable sports network ESPN reports that his injuries are not believed to be life-threatening. Video of the crash scene showed his dark gray sport utility vehicle badly crumpled at the bottom of the hill with windows smashed. He was alone in the car and no other vehicles were involved. Afghanistan began its first COVID-19 vaccinations Tuesday, initially administering doses to security force members, healthcare workers, and journalists. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani say people should not get complacent despite the rollout. Taliban insurgents have announced their support for the vaccination campaign. Afghan health officials say the international COVAX program will provide vaccines to cover 20% of the country's population. And in Ecuador, more than 50 people have died in riots in three prisons that the government described on Tuesday as a concerted action by criminal organizations. President Lenin Moreno has sought to control prison violence in the Andean country, declaring the prison system in a state of emergency due to frequent confrontations between criminal gangs. The Attorney General of the U.S. state of New York announced Tuesday that a grand jury voted not to charge the police officers involved in the death of black man Daniel Prude in the town of Rochester last year. The death of 41-year-old Prude sparked nightly protests after video of his arrest was released. That video shows Prude struggling to breathe, handcuffed and naked with a bag over his head as an officer pushes his face against the ground. Lawyers for the seven officers suspended over Prude's death say they were strictly following training. The county medical examiner lists the manner of death as a homicide. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Malaysia has sent more than 1,000 Myanmar nationals back to their strife-torn homeland on Tuesday, despite a court order to halt the deportation. Olivia Chan of Reuters reports.
Malaysia has defied a court order to halt the deportation of Myanmar nationals, sending 1,086 people back to their homeland. The Myanmar citizens were sent back on Tuesday on three Navy ships sent by the country's military, which seized power in a February 1st coup. Malaysia had initially said it would deport 1,200 Myanmar citizens. It also vowed not to deport Rohingya Muslims or refugees registered with the UN High Commission for Refugees, or UNHCR. But the agency has said at least six people registered with it are among the deportees. Refugee groups also say asylum seekers from the minority Chin, Kachin and non-Rohingya Muslim communities are also fleeing conflict and persecution at home, and they are among those being deported. Malaysia's Immigration Department Director General said the repatriated Myanmar citizens did not include Rohingya refugees or asylum seekers. He said, quote, all those returned had agreed to be sent back voluntarily without being forced by any party. He did not respond to queries on why the repatriation was carried out despite the halt ordered by the Kuala Lumpur High Court. The court had granted a stay until 10 a.m. on Wednesday local time, when it was scheduled to hear an application by rights groups for a judicial review to suspend the deportation. Those deported had been detained for immigration offenses. Malaysia does not formally recognize refugees, treating them as undocumented migrants. The Southeast Asian nation is home to more than 154,000 asylum seekers from Myanmar.
That was Olivia Chan of Reuters. The UN Refugee Agency reports violence in Ethiopia's western Benishangul-Gumuz region has sent thousands of people fleeing for safety to Sudan's Blue Nile state in recent weeks. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Insecurity in Ethiopia's Metekel zone in Benishangul-Gumuz region has been ongoing since 2019. However, tensions in the region have rapidly escalated in the past 3 months. The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission reports an estimated 500 people have been killed in the region in the last 5 months. Of these, it says more than 200 lost their lives in just one day. On December 23rd, UN Refugee Agency spokesman Baba Baluch says the escalating violence has prompted several thousand people to seek refuge in Sudan's Blue Nile state over the last month.
The refugee arrivals itself started in November with a couple of hundred refugees crossing into Sudan. But in the last few weeks, the number has picked up, and we now have an estimated 7,000. I mean, the stories that refugees are bringing are fleeing attacks from their opponents.
The escalating violence prompted the federal government of Ethiopia to declare a state of emergency in the Metekel zone on January 21st. Baluch says many of the refugees who recently fled Ethiopia have arrived in hard-to-reach locations along the border. He says the UNHCR is working closely with Sudanese authorities and partners to assess the situation and respond to the humanitarian needs of the refugees from Benishangul Gumuz.
The region is in western Ethiopia. As I currently understand, this displacement is not directly related to the conflict in the country's northern Tigray region, which have pushed more than 61,000 refugees to seek safety in Sudan in recent months.
Baluch says the majority of the asylum seekers are living among the Sudanese host community. So far, he says, nearly 3,000 refugees have been registered and nearly 1,000 have been provided with food, water and sanitation, and access to health and aid supplies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Indian and Chinese troops have withdrawn from a disputed border that triggered a 9-month-long standoff between the two countries. Rebuilding relations will not be easy, but as Anjana Pasrika reports from New Delhi, trade ties between the two large Asian economies are expected to improve.
Chinese and Indian artillery and tanks have rolled back, and soldiers have retreated from the banks of the strategic Pangong Lake, which straddles their border in the Himalayas. In video released on the pullback, the Indian Army said temporary structures erected by the Chinese have been dismantled. The disengagement after a 9-month standoff from the most fractious point in India's Ladakh region is significant, but it is only a start, according to Jayadev Ranade at New Delhi Center for China Analysis and Strategy.
It's a first step, it's a tentative step. But yes, it is aimed at diffusing the tension which exists, and particularly at this spot around Pangong.
Indian Defence Minister Rajnath Singh told Parliament earlier this month that disputes persist along the border known as the Line of Actual Control, or LAC. Singh said there are still some outstanding issues with regard to deployment and patrolling at the LAC, and these would be in focus during further discussions. Talks have started on stepping back from three other friction points along the border in Ladakh. But tensions in the Himalayas are likely to simmer amid growing suspicion in India, which has accused China of border incursions.
The main point is that, what did the Chinese hope to achieve by doing what they did? What was their intention? And certainly those will be factors that will be in the minds of the Indian planners, and will ensure that we will be vigilant in future, more vigilant in future for Chinese actions.
Restoring economic ties may be easier. India banned Chinese apps such as TikTok and raised barriers to Chinese investment as military tensions spiked last year. There were growing calls to boycott Chinese goods amid increasing nationalist sentiment. But Chinese goods, from low-cost accessories to mobile phones, continue to flood Indian markets. Many Indian industries, such as pharmaceuticals and solar power, remain dependent on Chinese components. Indian exports to China grew last year, points out Biswajit Dhar, a trade analyst and economics professor at New Delhi's Jawaharlal Nehru University.
Indian industry is now looking at China as a market, and China has offered them India the market. So I think the push is going to be both ways. Earlier, the push was only, from the sectors which were dependent on imports from China. Now there are these sectors like steel and others who are dependent on market in China. So I think there's going to be a substantially large constituency in India which will be seeking normalization of relations with China.
That means political and economic ties between Asia's two biggest countries could move on divergent paths. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
A non-binding motion in Canada's lower house of parliament claims that China's treatment of Uyghur Muslims constitutes genocide. The motion may pile more pressure on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to take a tougher line on the issue. Saraya Ali of Reuters reports.
Canada's lower house of parliament has voted in favor of labeling China's treatment of Uyghur Muslims as genocide in a symbolic move that may pile more pressure on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government to take a harder line on the issue and follow the U.S. government's similar accusations. Monday's vote in the House of Commons passed 266-0, although Trudeau and his cabinet abstained. The House has a total of 338 members. The vote was non-binding, although it was backed by all opposition parties and some members of Trudeau's own Liberal Party. Trudeau has been reluctant to use the word genocide and has suggested that he wants broader consensus among Western allies over the vast complexes that China has set up in the Xinjiang province. China calls them vocational training centers to combat extremism and has strictly denied allegations of human rights abuses within them. On Tuesday, China's foreign ministry called Canada's vote a smear that disregards facts and common sense. Former U.S. President Donald Trump, on his last day of office, said China had committed genocide and crimes against humanity by repressing Uyghur Muslims. The Biden administration is poised to uphold that position.
That was Saraya Ali of Reuters. Linguists and Braille experts in Mali have translated the country's most widely spoken language, Bambara, into Braille for the country's blind. Bambara is spoken and understood by about 15 million Malians, even more than the colonial language French. Anne Reisenberg profiles a teacher of the new translation in this report from Bamako.
Moussa Keita has been at the Malian Union of the Blind, UMAV, since childhood. First as a student, and now as a teacher. He is one of six instructors who will soon teach Braille in Bambara, the country's most widely spoken language. Before now, students learned Braille in Mali's colonial language, French. In the shade of a tree by his classroom on the UMAV campus, Keita explains his pride in Bambara Braille.
Quand je pense, n'est-ce pas, au projet qui a pensé non seulement aux handicapés visuels.
When I think of this project, he says, that thought not just of the visually handicapped, but moreover, that thought of Africans, particularly of Malians, to write Braille in their own language, to try and adapt Braille to Bambara, which isn't even the official language. Really, it's a feeling of pride and joy for us. Keita's student, 15-year-old Abdoulaye Kane, explains the usefulness of Bambara Braille to him in the classroom. He says that now, if you don't understand how to write something in French, you can write and read the word in Bambara. Then, you can understand how to write it in French, he says. Abdoulaye Diallo is a blind physical therapist and a Braille specialist. Diallo writes prescriptions and patient information on paper with a tool called a slate and stylus. The Braille is then translated into written French by clinic staff. Taking a pause from treating patients, Diallo sits behind his clinic and talks about how teaching Braille in Bambara is a breakthrough for students and for blind adults who never had the chance to go to school. If I'm an adult, illiterate, and I'm going to learn Bambara, he says, but I can see, I learn Bambara and I can do whatever I want. He says, if I'm an adult, but I'm blind, and I don't know Bambara, I'm in the margins. So, it's this Bambara Braille, he says, which will save, which will give autonomy to all these people who were in the margins. Isiaka Balo, a linguist expert at the University of Bamako, was contacted in 2019 by a nonprofit group called Sightsavers to spearhead the project to adapt Braille to Bambara. Bambara has more letters than the French alphabet and more intonation, so new letters had to be created, but only within the 6 points available in the Braille cell. Speaking from the Braille printing room at UMAV, Balo says blind students in Mali will now have more access to education. If they can learn these subjects in their language, he says, I think that will only strengthen the knowledge and mastery of science, the knowledge and mastery of literature, the knowledge about the world around us. In many schools, instruction is done in the local language rather than in French. Balo says the next step is to translate Mali's other national languages, like Fulani and Songhai, into Braille. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako.
Orangutans are a critically endangered species, but the coronavirus pandemic has halted efforts to protect and increase their population. However, as VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, rescue efforts in Indonesia are back underway.
The first few steps of freedom for these orangutans in Indonesia. The great apes, a relative of humans, have been under the care of the Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation. There, veterinarians and specialists work with orangutans on the skills they'll need to survive after having been rescued from captivity. The coronavirus pandemic derailed much of their work, including plans to release the animals into the wild. Now, CEO Jamartin Sahid says it's time to get back to work.
After almost a year, we have managed to curb the spread of COVID-19 in our rehabilitation center, and a large number of orangutans are ready to be released into the wild. We think now is the time for Bush Foundation to carry out orangutan releases back again.
A helicopter meets the guest of honor at an airport and flies the orangutan deep into the forest, avoiding civilization en route to the wild, where veterinarians like Patrick Flagoletta remain vigilant.
We will carry out of the patrol and make sure the orangutan still in the good health.
In all, staff with the Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation released 10 orangutans, but say they still have much to do. Orangutans are considered critically endangered, meaning the species is at high risk of extinction. The foundation cares for more than 400 of the great apes. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
That was Arash Arabasadi, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, and our editor, Bill Eagle, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On February 24th, the Voice of America celebrates the 79th anniversary of its first broadcast. In the dark early days of the Second World War, the United States government concluded that there was a need to counteract Nazi propaganda by establishing its own outlet, which would offer accurate and unbiased news and information. Thus, the Voice of America was founded on February 1, 1942, and broadcast its first 15-minute show in German on February 24th.
Hier spricht die Stimme Amerikas. Heute und täglich von heute an.
This is a voice speaking from America. Daily at this time, we shall speak to you about America and the war. The news may be good or bad. We shall tell you the truth.
From the beginning, the Voice of America has sought to provide a window into American life. Indeed, as required by law, the VOA must present accurate, objective, and comprehensive news, a balanced, comprehensive projection of significant American thought and institutions, as well as the policies of the United States. It is the task of the Voice of America to tell America's story around the world, said President John Kennedy on VOA's 20th anniversary.
This is an extremely difficult and sensitive task. On the one hand, you are an arm of the government and therefore an arm of the nation. And it is your task to bring our story around the world in a way which serves to represent democracy and the United States in its most favorable light. But on the other hand, as part of the cause of freedom and the arm of freedom, you are obliged to tell our story in a truthful way, to tell our, as Oliver Cromwell said about his portrait, to paint us with all our blemishes and warts, all the things about us that may not be so immediately attractive.
Forward. Forward. 20 feet down, 2.5.
And so, people around the world heard the century's great events on The Voice of America, including a record 615 million people who listened to the July 20th, 1969 moon landing.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
As the State Department said in a tweet on February 1st, 2021, during its first broadcast, VOA told listeners, "The news may be good or bad. We shall tell you the truth." From that broadcast to today, VOA has informed, engaged, and connected people around the world in support of freedom and democracy. That was